This is Jarrett Hill interviewing William H. Rutledge on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. This interview is taking place on September 13th, 2023 at the Amelia Island Museum of History as part of the museum's Heritage Keepers Project. With us in the room is Diane Sibilla, Mr. Rutledge's niece. Mr. Rutledge, how are you doing today?
Great.
Good. Could you tell me a little bit about your life before you came to Fernandina?
Let's start with my parents in Waycross, Georgia. My grandfather, Dr. George Atwood, went to Waycross in 1925, and he became the first doctor for the county, and he became the county health commissioner. And before that time, they had never had inoculations for the children in school. They had made inspections on milk products. There were many things that related to the health of Waycross and Ware County, Georgia, that he introduced. So he had 8 children who came along with him, and my mother was one of those. And she was, at the time, about 20. And they all went to the Episcopal Church in Waycross. And in 1925, she met my father, who was working at the Atlantic Coastline Railroad in Waycross. And they were both in the choir. In 26, they became engaged. In 27, they were married at the church in Waycross. And then my father found a job and with the Chesapeake and Ohio Railroad in Russell, Kentucky. So they moved there, and I was born when they were living in Russell, Kentucky. I was born on the 23rd of July, 1928, but I wasn't born on the Kentucky side because we were right on the Ohio River. The nearest hospital was in Ohio, Ironton, Ohio. So I was born at Deaconess Hospital in Ironton, Ohio, which is immediately across the river from Russell, Kentucky. First time we came to Fernandina, we came from Waycross. We were in Waycross on vacation. So my grandfather liked to come down and fish for sharks. And he used to go down to Center Street, Atlantic Avenue, and the dock was there. And he would fish for sharks in there, and he'd catch them. And we even had some young people down here who'd go swimming there, and I thought they were out of their minds. He'd do that. So meanwhile, we would be out at the beach, and we'd rent normally a rental home for about a week. First time was 1933, and we were in what was then called Bucks Beach. It was called Bucks Beach because the Bucks Real Estate Company, which I understood was under the ownership of some gentleman named Buck. It was south of Saddler Road. So we rented for about a week there. And I have some pictures still where I would be out playing in the sloughs as a young child. And I had a bucket and shovel that we got from Allen's store. And I still have the shovel. And I have a copy of the shovel that's in the memoirs, which are in your file. So that was the first time we came to Fernandina. Then, subsequent times, we'd come in the summer, and then we'd come down and visit Fernandina. In 1937, we were back in Kentucky. My grandfather, Rutledge, had died the year before in a train accident, and they were settling his estate. So my grandmother received a certain number of thousands of dollars because it was an accident that was preventable, but it was poor maintenance, and a steam locomotive was pierced the steam line, and he and his associate who was working in the cab were both killed. After that money was received by my grandmother, she divided it to her children. So my father received, I think approximately $6,000 or $7,000, which in the 1930s was a lot of money. Because of this, and we'd been down here many times, he and my mother decided, why don't we just move to Fernandina? So they contacted my grandfather in Georgia, and he got someone who was a carpenter mm-hmm. and a person of many talents to go build a house out on Fletcher Avenue. So we first had to buy the lot. So my father bought the lot from Mr. Goldstein. Mr. Goldstein ran the bakery, which was on Atlantic Avenue. He later became the postmaster. So the lot was purchased for $250 in 1937. Mm-hmm. And then they started construction on the house. It was mostly completed in late 1937 and in early 38. In 37, they finished the upstairs part. It was going to be a garage apartment, like there were many along the beach. Then they found they had enough money left that they could finish the downstairs. So then we had two stories, one apartment upstairs, apartment downstairs. The whole investment, the land, the house, $3,000. We moved in first week in 1938. So I went to the fourth grade and started in Fernandina Elementary School. And my teacher was Mrs. Butler. Miss Butler was one of the great teachers ever. And her husband was the mayor of Fernandina for a number of years. He was president of the local Kiwanis Club, and he was also the chief executive for the state of Florida for the Kiwanis Club in mm-hmm. the 1940s. After we got settled in, then my mother and father decided he'd worked with the railroad his entire life. He started when he was 15 years old as an apprentice in Florence, South Carolina. Well, he had a leave of absence from the railroad in Kentucky, so he decided that they would go into the business on the beach. The casino at that time was owned by the city. It was a large wooden building. It had been constructed maybe 20, 30 years before. But it was multi-purpose. It was designed to be a bathhouse for people who would come to the beach and have no place to change, so they'd go there. Also, it had a restaurant upstairs. It had a large area that had been designed for multi-purpose. It was used for a while as a skating rink, but it also had a small stage, and they'd have special events there. It was before there was a gymnasium for the high school, so it was used for basketball. Hmm. So the Fernandina High School basketball teams, both girl and boy, they used that as their court until 1940 when the gymnasium was built at the high school. So my mother and father took out a lease on it, and they opened the restaurant, and they operated the restaurant in 1938 and 1939. In 1938 and 9, between that era, a gentleman, Mr. Hutchins, Charles Hutchins, he came to Fernandina and he asked if he might put some bowling alleys upstairs. So they did, and they brought these bowling alleys in and installed them on the east side upstairs, and they left the skating rink on the west side. After 2 years, we found that there was no business in the wintertime, so we weren't getting any income. So my father would have to go back to Kentucky and work in order to meet our expenses. And then after these 2 years, and then my mother having to keep the place open, they decided to sell their interest to the Hutchins family, which they did. And then the Hutchins family continued to operate the whole casino for almost another 10 years, until they built the Seaside Inn right down at the intersection of Fletcher and Sadler Road. Mm-hmm. You'll be amazed to see the prices. It cost $100 a month to rent the casino, which was fine, mm-hmm. except in the winter when you got no income. And they couldn't afford it. So that's why they sold their interest in their inventory to the other family. And then my father went back to work for the railroad. Now, he'd worked originally for the Atlantic Coast Line as a child when he started when he was 15. Then he worked for the Chesapeake in Ohio, when I was born. He came here, and then in 1940, he decided to work for Seaboard. So he worked for Seaboard in Jacksonville, and he commuted from Fernandina. So that brings us up to the 1940 era, and we're getting close to World War II. Are there any other areas that you would have interest in before the war era?
Definitely. Did you or other students from Fernandina Elementary, Fernandina High, did you all interact with students from Peck?
No. Mm-hmm. No, not at all. There was a complete separation from the white community and the black community. There was same thing was true at the theaters. The theater balcony was all for the black students, and the ground floor was all for the white members of the community. It was a pattern all over the South, and that was characteristic of it. The communities were almost like a community within a community. The students who went to Peck High School, first grade through 12th, they went to there. And actually, Mr. Peck was the principal. That's how the name came about. I don't remember ever meeting him, but I do know that when I talked to the county recorder at the courthouse one time, I was older, I was going to register to vote. I was asking her about things, and she said, well, we have three Republicans in Nassau County. Said, you're surely going to register as a Democrat. Well, that's the only way you get a vote in, because the primaries determined everything. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, who are the registered Republicans? And she said, well, Mr. Peck is a registered Republican. One gentleman who works at the post office is a registered Republican. He was also a black citizen. And he said, your high school coach is a Republican. And he's from North Carolina originally. I said, amazing. He was a very individual thinker, but he was a very smart man. So I registered, which in those days you had to be 21 to register, which I think we still should, but that's that. We probably should go back, really, to 1940, that era, because when we first moved here, first of all, in 1939 and 1940, there was a decision in 39, especially, was the Naval Air Station going to be here, or was it going to be in Jacksonville? And there was a third option, and I don't recall what it was. So there was a lot of talk in Fernandina about, well, we may be the site for a new Naval Air Station, but it ended up being more down near Orange Park. Mm-hmm. And always I felt it was because of logistic accessibility of railroad service and others, and that we were too isolated. We only had the railroad line that came out here, and it would be very difficult, not only in constructing the airport, but everything else that went with it. So it was located there. But it's important to recognize that Amelia Island was one of the final three places before they made the selection to build. They started building there in 1940. Mm-hmm. Then, in that same era, 1940, as an individual, I moved around a lot because my father would work in Kentucky sometime and back and forth. He actually was working up there in 1939 and 1940, so I was living in Waycross for a short time. But still, Fernandina was our home from 38 on. There was a general preparation towards war starting in 1940s, because the industries were supporting a lot going to France and to England. So it was a huge market, and so that was expanding. But we still had very small military. We had a Coast Guard cutter here, and of course the man who ran the lighthouse, Mr. O'Hagan, was in the Coast Guard, although we never saw him in a uniform until after Pearl Harbor. He and his family ran the lighthouse, I think, for generations. When attack came in Pearl Harbor on Sunday, the 7th of December, 1941. People are always speculating, where were you then? Where were you? What'd you know? Well, I had been, it was a Sunday, I had been at church. By that time, I was in the choir and I was training to be an acolyte at St. Peter's Church. And I was at the beach, and I had been over to the casino to perhaps have something to eat for lunch. Mm-hmm. And by the time, it was about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, I was walking across the parking lot there, and somebody came up, and I can't remember exactly who it was. And he said, did you hear the news? And I said, what, about what? He said, the Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor. Well, I knew where Pearl Harbor was. Mm-hmm. A lot of people didn't. I was 13 years old, but I liked history, I liked geography. But the reason I knew more about it was the summer before, so we're talking about the summer of 1940, my father came home one day and he said, oh, how would you like to move to Hawaii? And I said, that'd be great, fine. And my mother said, what are you talking about? And my father said, the Navy is advertising that they need machinists mm-hmm. to work in their shops to help do repairs on their ships and their airplanes in Pearl Harbor, which is in Hawaii and Honolulu. And he said, I'm thinking about maybe applying. And my mother said, we're not going anywhere. Forget about going to Hawaii. I never heard anything more about going to Hawaii until December the 7th. So I knew where it was. Mm-hmm. Whereas many people said, where is that? Where is it? So forth. Well, it was where the anchorage was for our whole Pacific Navy is where it was. When it happened, everything changed on Amelia Island. It changed all over the country. Mm-hmm. Within days, we started feeling the impact of what was going to come with the war. And one of those very first things that happened was rationing for tires, because in those days we were getting all the rubber from the Far East. We didn't have synthetic rubbers and things in those days for cars. So there was a quick freeze on the sale of tires. And then eventually, within the next year or so, they started recapping tires, so you keep them. And if you had a certain job that was considered war essential, mm-hmm. there may on some occasions be an opportunity to buy new tires, but very rarely. Mm-hmm. And also one of the other quick problems was the control of gasoline. The gasoline, there were different kinds of certificates you'd get. You'd get a book of tickets, you know, A, B, and C, and maybe there were several other categories. But everyone was entitled to A ticket. Well, A gave you the least amount of gasoline, mm-hmm. and this was only so that you could probably go somewhere on the island, but you couldn't go, you probably wouldn't go to Jacksonville, you wouldn't do it often, because it was a very limited amount of gas. And then B would be a little bit more. C would be people who normally had to commute to work. Like my father had a C because he had to go to Jacksonville to work in the railroad, which was considered an essential war industry. Mm-hmm. So those were happening. Then you started having rationing in clothing and in food and shoes. The food aspect, there was an early rationing on sugar. Why? Because a lot of the sugar was coming from different sources that were endangered by the Japanese. Some of the sugar was coming from Hawaii, some was coming from Cuba, but also there was submarines around that were endangering a lot of these things. So there were many things that impacted upon the families as far as availability of foods and items that were or were not essential. But one of the first big impacts that affected everybody on this island was the blackouts. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we didn't go to the blackouts instantly, which we should have. We didn't go to the blackouts until just about June of 1942. But before that time, from December on, we had the worst loss of merchant ships in the whole history of the war, because as the ships would be going in and out of port, German submarines were sitting out, and the ships were silhouetted by all the lights along the coast. Mm-hmm. The first realization of how important this was in the first week in April 1942, when the Gulf America, which was a new tanker, was coming into the port in St. John's River, and just outside of Jacksonville, and it had not yet gotten into the entrance to the river, and it got hit the German submarine. Mm-hmm. For those of us who lived on the beach, we could see it burning. We didn't hear the impact, but it wasn't long that the flames were evident enough that people were passing word along, go out and look and see what's going on. Yeah. So we did. And I remember very distinctly looking south, and I said, hey, that's got to be going into the river. That would be the only way. It would be being that close. So we saw that, and as a result of the ship sinking, and it was a tanker, and all the burning and everything, tar was developed from all of the petroleum. And all along the beach, you're talking about 17 miles from the fort all the way to the sound, there was little clods of tar all over the beach. And there was a lot of people concerned about, well, what are we going to do about it? Well, it was too messy for anybody to do anything about it. You had to just let nature take care of itself. So within a few weeks, because of the weight of the tar and the tides in and out, it gradually just sunk down below the surface level, so you couldn't see it. It got to the point where it wasn't a nuisance if you wanted to go swimming or go out in the water, because same situation applied. It was weight of the tar versus sand and the water flow, and gradually it's gone. Now, one thing it did also relate, one of the lifeboats from the ship came loose, and they didn't use it, and it came ashore on Amelia Island, and it was turned over to the Coast Guard. They examined it, and then they gave the lifeboat to the Sea Scouts. Mm-hmm. I saw the boat. I don't know whatever happened to it afterwards. I wasn't old enough to be a Sea Scout, but I do know that they got the boat. And that was one of the earlier indications. Now, right after that, very shortly after that, within weeks, the blackout hit Fernandina. It hit the whole East Coast, period. Mm-hmm. Not only the East Coast, but also a lot of the Gulf, because the German submarines were operating from Maine all the way around to Texas and all the way south to Venezuela. The blackout was very effective. The impact in Fernandina was immediately that families were urged to either get black curtains, turn off the lights at night, mm-hmm. anything that's faced the ocean. One thing was used, which was very inexpensive, were shades. And you'd get the window shade and put it up, and it was black. Then you'd have to try to be sure it was shielded along either side so there was no light coming out. And the whole concept, stop this white background to help protect your ships. Mm-hmm. And it's very important. Every street light in Fernandina on the eastern side was painted black. On the western side, the top part was painted black. And so the only light coming out of street lights was the lower part on the west side. The same thing was done to automobiles. The headlights in automobiles, the top part, which would normally be for bright lights, all black, painted on all cars. And of course, in the rear, you didn't have any backup things in those days, so everything was just a red light anyhow. Mm-hmm. No matter where, it didn't have to be just on the beach. In the town, anything that's facing east, they had to, in some way, restrict the lighting from them so that it was not creating this silhouette that would enhance the submarine officers. It was a very effective time. It was really dark. And when you had a black night in Fernandina, during that era, I mean, it was black. Mm-hmm. It was really dark. And people weren't driving far. They didn't have any gas, and it was really dark. I lived at the beach. There were times that I might be in town, and it might get dark, especially in the winter. I might walk all the way to the beach and then all the way down the beach to my house and never see any light. You could carry a flashlight if you pointed it down at the ground, but everything was very careful. Now, another thing that related to this was in about March of 1942, there were German saboteurs who were landed, 30 miles south of Fernandina and on the beach, and also landed on Long Island. By some good fortune, some of the people who were landed had previously lived in America, and one or more of them saw an opportunity to perhaps escape the war. But nevertheless, they were picked up by the FBI and they testified. Ultimately, some of them were executed, and some of them were imprisoned, and later on were let out after the war was over. But what it did, it created a great scare that there was going to be a lot of sabotage to our industry, because there had been some in World War I, but this, they had great fear of this. Well, this was going along at the same time that the blackouts were happening. So between the blackouts and the fear of saboteurs, this gave birth to the Coast Guard Horse Patrol. Mm-hmm. In Fernandina and all up and down the coast, we had the Horse Patrol started sometime probably about early summer, 1942, and I don't know where they got their riders, but I wouldn't doubt it if they hadn't gotten volunteers from the West, from where most everybody out in that era, if they were ranchers or farmers and so forth, they were horse riders. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, we had a horse corral and stables down near the South Jetty, approximately 400 or 500 yards south and west of the water. So there's a big flat area down there, and those were built. And then these young men were assigned early on, and every night they would be up and down the coast from one end of the island to the other, and they were looking for light. And so they were a security to enhance the effectiveness of the blackout, but also because of this great fear of landing saboteurs. And what was interesting, though, is that in history, as we went back and checked from the German side, when they saw, they were so disappointed with the failure of the landings of their people in the late spring of 1942, they canceled the program. Well, we didn't know. So we kept thinking, oh, it's a continual threat. It wasn't a continual threat. Mm-hmm. They kept the horses and the people until we landed in Normandy. And when we finally landed in Normandy, they thought, well, we really probably don't need the horse patrol anymore. So they just faded away. Mm-hmm. We had a personal experience in our family in that winter in early 1942. My father was commuting to Jacksonville to go to work in the railroad. One morning, he was going south on Fletcher Avenue. A Coast Guard Jeep with two or more Coast Guard members in it. And we had a very thick fog, and they crossed over that center line and hit my father's car head on the driver's side. And so he had a severe knee injury, and the car was badly damaged, but was later repaired and put back in service. But he had to go to Waycross to have surgical work on his left knee, almost like a football injury, because mm-hmm. it was impact. There was not all this tearing up of interior of the car, but just the thrust of being forced forward mm-hmm. upon impact shattered his left knee. And we know that the only reason the Coast Guard people were out there was because of the horse patrol. Mm-hmm. Because there's no reason in the world for somebody who's on a cutter down a center street in the dock, they wouldn't be out there for anything. So that pretty well indicated to us that was a time element where the proximity of the horse patrol and when our accident occurred in the spring of 1942. Mm-hmm. And also, during all these times, they also developed access to the island. And people had to get special passes by the port authority, mm-hmm. and they would issue a photo pass just like a driver's license today. And it would they'd take your picture and put it on there and laminate it. And I don't recall all the details, but I remember my mother having this and having a card and carrying it around. One of the interesting things is they might have had this, but I don't ever remember seeing anybody at the bridges coming onto the island, and there was only one bridge, to check any cards. Mm-hmm. So a lot of things were cosmetic. A lot of things were done on theory. Mm-hmm. And one of the other theory things was really funny. We built these towers all along the coast. We're going to be aircraft spotters. And even in high school, in our classes, we would build model airplanes, and it'd be painted black. We'd use out of balsa wood and be painted black, and they were to be representing silhouettes of German aircraft. Some were not only bombers, but some were fighter planes. Mm-hmm. Well, our coach and our physics teacher said, and who was a pilot, Mr. Miller, A.A. Miller, he said, "This is crazy." He said, "First of all, there is no airplane built in the world that can reach North Florida from Germany. None. Or from France, from anywhere in Europe." He said, "This is strictly to let people feel involved." We had the tower. It was built about, probably 2 to 3 blocks north of where the casino was, or north of Atlantic Avenue, mm-hmm. right off of Fletcher, so you'd have access there. And a ladder was built so you'd climb up and there and you had a covering over it. So, and you had binoculars up there so you could look out and see all these airplanes that were going to come. And they got false reports all up and down the coast, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. Oh, this happened. Oh, so forth. Well, nobody ever found any kind of a real airplane.
And these were civilians that were in the towers?
Volunteers from the community. Most were mature people, but some teenagers mm-hmm. would volunteer and go out there. It was, again, an assumption that it's a threat when it wasn't a threat. And it was supposedly, it was a good morale booster. Now, there was another thing that was sort of funny, is that we had air raid wardens. Mm-hmm. And so the chief of the air raid warden staff in Fernandina was also the rector of St. Peter's Church. I guess he needed a prayer for it, so they didn't come. But he had one of these hard hats. It was painted on there. So he was the boss. And this was done all after we already had a blackout. We had all these other stuff. But it was done with the idea, if anything ever does happen, it may not be from the air. It might be from the sea. It might be anywhere. But still we called him an air raid warden because that's what they were in England when they were getting bombed terribly by the Germans. So there were a lot of things that happened during that era that impacted. Now, one thing that was directly related to Fernandina High School, I was in when the war started, I was in the 8th grade. It was continuing on, and when I was in the 10th grade, I had a teacher named Marguerite Ward, one of the greatest teachers I ever had in my life, not only in public school, but in college. And I had teachers for 9 years in college at six different venues, but I never had a teacher as good as Miss Marguerite Ward at this school. Mm-hmm. She decided that she wanted more books, and our library was very limited, the school library. She came up with the idea where we're going to buy our books, but we're going to have to figure out how to get the money. So what she did, she had all the boys bring sugar ration certificates to school, or they can bring a pound of sugar. And then the girls would take the ration tickets or the sugar, or they'd go buy some sugar with them, and they'd bake cakes. And they would bake the cakes, and on Wednesday morning, since stores closed at noon on Wednesdays back in those days, mm-hmm. they would set up their card table right in front of Allen's store, and they would display the cakes, and they would sell the cakes. Well, they always sold the cakes, because there was no bakery in Fernandina, and sugar was rationed, and this was a good deal for somebody to come along and be able to get a nice cake when they couldn't even bake it themselves, probably. So it worked, and the money came in, and Miss Ward arranged to buy an entire set of the Encyclopedia Britannica for her room. Mm-hmm. And then she decided she needed some more books, so we bought a whole set of Shakespeare's plays. And then we had to get some more contemporary books. So then she selected book titles from contemporary authors that she thought we should read. So before long, we had one whole wall of books in our classroom where Miss Ward was. And in those days, the teachers didn't move around. They stayed in their room and the students moved. So she was there protecting the books. And the reason she had them is that Miss Ward said, "Well, you're going to learn a lot by these, but we're going to use your regular textbooks, and we'll have regular lectures and other things, but we're going to supplement with this. Now, you can do really well on my exams, but you can't get an A for the term unless you do X number of book reports. And you're going to be able to, because they're right in this room. And not only that, I'm going to check them out to you, and you're going to read them, and you're going to write a book report. Mm-hmm. And I think you've done a good job, and you've also passed all the tests, you could make an A in the course." So she had very high standards. Mm-hmm. And not only that, she taught civics, she taught Western civilization, she taught American history. She taught English, English grammar, she was especially good at, and English literature. This is one person. And Miss Ward was partially paralyzed. She had a wheelchair. She also had a special bench. It was put so that if she were especially tired, she could lie down on it. She did not have a teaching certificate. It wasn't required during the war. And she had never even been to Fernandina until a friend of hers took her, brought her out to the school and introduced her to the principal and told about her background and her capabilities, because she'd previously taught somewhere. And she graduated from, I think it was called St. Mary's College. Anyhow, it was an annex to Notre Dame University when there was still separation between the men and the women at that university. She was unbelievably great and did a marvelous job, and very creative. She would do, she communicated directly with the University of Florida Art Department and had them send many pictures already framed, original done by the students, and she displayed them in her room and up and down the halls. She also got them to send her RCA Red Seal records, which were for classics on music. That would come up, she'd play that. One time she decided that the young ladies should act as hostesses for teas, and they should invite some of the older ladies from the community to come out, and they would therefore learn how to be a hostess and greet people and introduce people, try to select individuals who themselves might be able to add some personal aspects that would be of interest.
Mm-hmm.
She also brought her canary one day and brought it in the cage and just opened up the cage and let the bird fly all around in the room. She was interesting. She was very interesting. One time she was at the blackboard because she could stand sometime, and somebody was doing something and she didn't want. She turned around and picked up one of the erasers off the blackboard and threw it straight back and hit the person that she wanted to get their attention. Another day, we had one member of the class who had a milk route. His name was Vernon, and Vernon Allen, and he had to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. He was often tired, sleepy. So one day we were having class, and Vernon fell asleep. And there were two young girls sitting not too far away. And they waved their hands and said, "Miss Ward, Miss Ward, Vernon's asleep." And Miss Ward said, "Shh, be quiet." She said, "Vernon will learn more asleep than you two girls do awake." That quote, mm-hmm. That's what she said. It is so memorable. After all these years, I still recall the incident. This was one of the things that's occurred. Because of the war, some of our teachers were taken away. They, like the chemistry teacher, he was a graduate of the University of Florida also, and he was a coach. He was drafted, but because he was a teacher, he was sent to Camp Lanning, and he taught how to fire machine guns. So his whole job during the war was that. He became a master sergeant as an instructor down there. Mm-hmm. And then later he came back and taught chemistry to us in our senior year in high school. Later, he became the county school superintendent, and later he moved to South Florida, where he also took over a big, big school district in Fort Lauderdale area. Very unfortunately, in his 50s, he developed early Alzheimer's and died. He was a great teacher, a great administrator, and he also had been principal at Ely High School for a while. So there were a lot of things in that era, 1941 to 45, that were significant. Now, one thing was relative is that Fernandina was one of the rare places that had so few casualties during the war. There were only two known casualties that we knew of. One of them was a Fernandina High School graduate named Jimmy Bird. Jimmy Bird was a gunner on a B-17 that was shot down over Belgium sometime in probably 43. And there was another man who worked at one of the mills, and I don't remember his name, but he was also a casualty of the war. But other than that, it was almost like the war wasn't impacting on our people is mm-hmm. the way it was. Now, there were almost everybody who was in the draftable age was in the military.
Mm-hmm.
A large percentage of those who had finished went to the Navy. I guess it was just because of our proximity here and their interest in the ocean. But nevertheless, there were more in the Navy than I can recall than in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
But they were in every branch. In Fernandina, of course, the paper mills were both working. Container and Kraft, it was called Kraft at that time, and it was also called Container and North. Okay, it opened officially for production first week in January 1938. Rainier did not open for about almost two more years. It just took that long for construction and to get production online. I worked at Rainier 3 summers.
Mm-hmm.
It taught me that I didn't want to work there when I got out of school, but it helped finance my education.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very fortunate, and I was pleased to get the jobs. But there was a correlation between our education and what was happening as far as our environment. Our house on Fletcher Avenue was directly directly east of Ryanair. So Ryanair decided that, first of all, when they started doing their production in the early 40s, they had to cook the wood, and therefore they used all sorts of chemicals. And they would pump out the waste into the Amelia River. It destroyed the oyster industry, and it also hurt the shrimping industry. So they decided, well, we're going to build a pipeline to the Atlantic Ocean, and then we're going to pump it out in the ocean. Mm-hmm. They did. They built a pipeline, and the pipeline came right beside our house. The pipeline was within 50 feet of my bedroom window. Mm-hmm. All the time they were building it in 1940. And so anyhow, they built it. And then they started pumping these chemicals out into the ocean. Well, what happened was, because of the chemical reaction, you got foam. This foam sometimes would be waist high, and it might be long, long areas all along, depending upon the flow of the water that day, and it smelled bad. It was one of the most visible signs of industrial waste and its effect upon the whole environment. But other factors were there too. Before they opened, most of the people in town used copper for their screens. Mm-hmm. And they also used lead paint. Lead paint was used both exterior and interior. What happened was, because of the wind flow, which is more often southwest to east, as far as that angle, because we got more odor from on the beach from Ryanair than we did from container. More of the container went to the north part. Well, within a few months after they started production, these copper screens in doors and windows all over, they would decompose and they'd fall because the chemicals from the mill was destroying them. Mm-hmm. And also, the house paint, you could go in the morning, and because of the humidity and the moisture, early in the morning, or if you had a foggy day especially, the moisture coming out of the smokestacks would coalesce with the other natural moisture in the air anyhow. And you could go in some parts of town, and if a house was painted white, it would be temporarily black. Hmm. Now, it wouldn't be all, but much of it would be where they had fresh lead paint. It was more prevalent if the paint was newer, more fluid, it hadn't set in things. But nevertheless, it would happen. Then when the sun would come out, it would get warm, goes back and it's white. Hmm. Now, our chemistry teacher would talk to us sometime about that. And you say, well, if it's doing that to your surfaces like that, what do you think it's doing to your lungs? We see most people wouldn't complain because they were economically dependent upon jobs at the paper mills. So they were able to do a lot. Now, they did try at the mills to screen out some of this, to protect people and to protect their own property, but not as successfully as you would hope. If you had a car and you rode out to the mill and you parked your car there for very long, and I mean not one day, but over a period, you're going to get rust. And just from the settling from the acid plant and also from other chemicals they were using, would settle on these metal surfaces, and it was very bad. Now, they had some shower capabilities to shower off your cars, but it was very limited, and most people were sort of skeptical, but not after a few months. and they started realizing, look, this is not very good. Even some people would pool their car rentals going out to work. Some would just walk to work and not endanger their cars. Mm-hmm. But this was another byproduct of what was happening during that era, during the war.
Mm-hmm. I was curious.
Sure.
In this period,
yeah.
Do you have any memories of interacting with the Civilian Conservation Corps group that was on the island?
Yeah, yes, very much. The CCC program was started in President Roosevelt's first administration. It was one of the alphabet organizations, and CCC was Civilian Conservation Corps, and then the added C was camp. And we had a Civilian Conservation Corps camp on North 14th Street. It came here in the mid-1930s, and its first project was to concentrate on restoring the historical value of Fort Clinch. And their first job was to go out and to dig all the sand out of the inside of the fort, which had accumulated since it was last used during the Spanish-American War. So we had approximately 30 years of abandonment out there, and they had to get all that out first. Then they had to clean up the residue that had accumulated over all that time. And then they gradually, they had a master plan, and their plan also included provisions for near the place where they could put a building or two so they could process in people coming in and out. And in about 1939 or 40, they actually built a brick building right close to the entrance to the fort that they could use to sell drinks and things and have meetings and other things.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first external construction that I ever saw out there. What their most important project was the Fort Road. They started on that early on. And when they did, first of all, up until they started working on it, when you got to Fort Road, you always went out 14th Street out as though you were going out towards Bosco Bella and out in that area and went on beyond. And that was the direct route to the fort. The road went out there. That road remained open for many years, even after they started working on the Fort Road. They started working on the Fort Road in the 30s, and they were continuing to work on it until it closed. The camp closed in 1942, late in 42,
mm-hmm.
because by that time, all the people who were in CCC were now in the military.
Yes.
And also, the reserve military who'd been working out there, they're on active duty, they're gone. My mother and I went out there for Thanksgiving dinner with the camp commander, Thanksgiving 1942. That was one of the last occasions that there was anything there.
Yeah.
And they were closing it down, because there were no people. But what they had done over a number of years, they had cut all through the virgin forest from the fort all the way to Atlantic Avenue. There was no paving or anything, but they had gone all the way,
mm-hmm.
because at the time we could go and walk, two or three blocks back from the beach where the entrance to the Fort Road is now, and it was all sand, and we could walk there if we wanted to all the way around to the fort. But that was a hard walk because the sand was all thick and hard. And piled up, and it's a lot better to walk on the beach all the way around if you want to walk to the fort.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to get to the fort, get in your car and go straight out there, because that was the way it was still available.
Mm-hmm.
So all the way up until after World War II, people had a direct route out by Old Town and by the cemetery and then straight in to the fort. And that was the access point. But it was cut through so that you could actually walk down there. He said, don't go down there at night for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, why? And he said, because there are Florida panthers. And I said, what's that? And he said, well, it's sort of like a mountain lion, and it's dangerous. And I said, well, how do you know they're there? And he said, because they make noise.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, like what? And he said, they sound like a woman crying. And I thought, it's a good idea not to go down there. And the one who told me this was my chemistry teacher,
mm-hmm.
who'd also told me how dangerous the mill products were, and all sorts of other things. He'd also said people that are up in those towers looking for airplanes are out of their minds. He was a common sense guy,
mm-hmm.
great man, and he was the only white Republican in Nassau County. It was A.A. Miller, great man, super guy. But he said, watch out for the Panthers.
Hmm.
Yeah. But the CCC camp itself at 14, on 14 was organized as an army camp, because what they did in order to start the camping program in the 30s, they took reserve officers from the United States Army, called them to active duty, and they were very happy because they probably couldn't have jobs either
mm-hmm.
during the Depression. And they would be camp commanders. Most of the camp commanders were captains. And then they would also activate some NCOs, but a lot of times they took NCOs out of the active army in order to be instructors on heavy equipment and also to run the mess halls, so that the mess sergeant generally was from the active army. They had good food. They built a sort of a multi-purpose building out there, out of prefab deal, out of sheet metal, and it had a big floor in it, so it was elevated, and it was used where they could have it as a dining room, or they could use it for movies. And they had 16mm, they run a 16mm movie circuit all over the country, so that different nights during the week they would get first run quality movies coming out of Hollywood. That was part of their compensation, because they actually were getting paid about like what was equivalent of a so-called army private, $21 a month. But their money was almost all going back to their families. They kept very little money. The reason being that many of them came in there and they had to volunteer was because there were no jobs in the 30s hardly for young men. These people generally, age span was about 17 to 27. Mm-hmm. It was at normal. We had people here from all over the country. A lot, of course, were from Florida. There were a number of people from down in Tampa, St. Petersburg. I got to know a number of them, because a lot of these people, these young men, would be come out to the casino and the beach in the summertime when my father was running the restaurant there. So consequently, I see them often, and a few of them then invited me out since I got to know them. And I remember going out there one night, having dinner, and then seeing the movie. One of the movies I saw was Alexander's Ragtime Band. It was a big movie, and it was talking about World War I, when the band members all got up and marched off and became members of the band, the United States Army. So this was sort of the peak in the story, the end, how the story ended. You saw all the program, it was very interesting, but right at the end they get up and they walk out and say, where are they going? They're going to the United States Army. That was one of the movies. Now they had all sorts of movies, but I could remember that one when I was about, I don't know, 10, 12. And it was fun. And I got to know those people. They wore issued uniforms. They were khaki, cotton, big high boots. Everything was just regular army. And it was run like an army camp. And it was well organized, great people, good workers. Many of the people came back to Ferrandina after the war was over. So Ferrandina gained in many ways. They gained from what work they did, and they gained from having some of them return, work in the mills, work in wherever they did, and but made Fernandina their home. One of the people who came back started the youth baseball program here. He married a local girl, great success as a coach, and he was from Tampa. The people who had come up from Cuba after the Spanish-American War, a lot of people came who were in the cigar-making business. Mm-hmm. So there were a lot of cigars being manufactured in Tampa for several decades. Ybor City, which was principally that portion of Tampa, which was Spanish-speaking and related to Cuba. I've been down there. One of the great restaurants in America is a Columbia restaurant in Ybor City. First time I ever had a good Cuban dinner, black bean soup, and a few other things, and it's a beautiful place. Mm-hmm. Great food. You've probably been there too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the CC program was a marvelous program. We think of it, we did in those days, and then even now, a lot of people think of it, and then we associate it with Fort Clinch in the road. But it was everywhere all over the country. It did unbelievable improvements in projects. If there were ever a government agency that had disappeared that I'd like to have come back, be the CCC program, because mm-hmm. it did more for America than any program that I can think of during the decade of the 30s. Mm-hmm. And in the West, very significant out there. I mean, Diane and I both have been out in the Denver area and saw much there. And then over toward in Arizona and other places out there, they just developed things. And so often it was restoration of natural resources, like Red Rocks, which is west of Denver. It's one of the most beautiful natural theaters, amphitheaters in the world. And they built it right in the town that I live in now, Fort Collins. They built the golf course. They did all sorts of varied things. And in some places they worked on planting trees. They might build a forest. They would do all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And there are some good documentary films on them. I hope sometime you can have access and show them. Mm-hmm. Because they did a good job of filming and investigating and interviewing in that era. And I, again, hope that you all have some success in tracking down more data, and it'd be great if you could find some survivors of the horse patrol, because mm-hmm. it was unique. It was here, it was gone, and often forgotten, mm-hmm. but it was a reality for those of us who lived in Fernandina 1942 to 1944.
Absolutely. I have two more things that I'd like to ask you about. I don't want to take up too much of your time, but yeah, I know just this week we passed the 80-year anniversary of you becoming Fernandina's first Eagle Scout. Could you tell me a little bit about that? When did you join? And
sure. Well, first of all, when I was a child in Kentucky, we lived across the street from where the Boy Scouts would meet. And I was 6 years old, first grade. And they would meet, and then they would play games and do things. And I thought, this would be fun. And so I told my father, I said, I'd like to be a Boy Scout. He said, well, you have to be 12 years old. And I said, okay. And then later, I became 12 years old. So I joined a Boy Scout Troop 7 in Waycross, Georgia in 1940. And then I was only there for a few months, staying at my grandparents. But then I came back to Fernandina and joined Troop 89 in the winter of 1940-41. We used to have our meetings at the Methodist Church, and the Methodist Church pastor there was our scoutmaster for a while. So that was my start, although I had gone, even while in Waycross, I'd gone to summer camp that we had out near Well, it was one of those CCC projects, really. It was developed, and it was a lake and a recreational area, and so we did tent camping out there, and then we had tests so you could be tenderfoot and then second class, first class. So I did a lot of those things that summer, but then I came back, and that the following winter I joined the troop here. So the winter after that, then, so we're now looking at summer 1941, I went to Camp Echagati down near Orange Park. It was a camp for the North Florida Conference for the Boy Scouts. And there you have a great opportunity to learn a lot in the scouting program. So I finished all my requirements for second class and first class that summer. 41. 42, I went back to camp and again did some more merit badges and other things. And that summer of 42, I also gained enough merit badges to become a Star Scout. Okay. So, before the end of the summer, then I got enough to become a Life Scout. So I remember going to a court of honor in Jacksonville on my 14th birthday and received my life badge and from Mr. Hyatt, whose mother used to own a house on North Beach, North Fletcher. Mm-hmm. And so we got to know their family, but he was a great. He was a graduate at the University of Florida, grew up in Gainesville, was on the swimming team. Later, he was the secretary of the Alumni Association. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, very early in his 50s, he died from cancer. Great, but a marvelous man. But he was a representative there who made the presentation. So, the summer following, summer 43, I went there and I was a cabin leader. I took more and more things, and by this time I was getting close to qualifying for an Eagle. That summer, my mother died in July, so I left camp and I came back home after a few weeks. And I had to do another couple of my merit badges to finish. You had to have 21 merit badges, and a lot of them were required, some were elective. So I finished and I got my Eagle Scout badge. It was presented in the courthouse here in Fernandina in September 1943. And it was the first time anyone in Fernandina had ever received it, and first in Nassau County, as far as I know. It was one of those things where I always wanted to be in the scouting program. I learned a lot of, I met a lot of great people. And it was like when you join something and if you want to achieve it, and you set your goals. And I wanted, early on, I wanted to be a Boy Scout and I wanted to be an Eagle Scout. And you only get there by working for it. And I was lucky, I was fortunate that I had the opportunities to go there. In the last two summers, I was a cabin leader, which meant it didn't cost me anything to go to camp, although it was very cheap. It was only $9 a week to be in camp, and that was for all of your meals and all of your training. Times have changed. But it was a great experience. It's like many other experiences you have in your life. It's separate, but it has an impact on your values, your dedication and work, and it also has a spin-off effect on what you do in school. Same way in school, when I was in Fernandina High School, I went to the graduation ceremony when I was in eighth grade, and I went to the auditorium, and I said, "What's going on? Who's speaking up there? What's that?" They said, "Well, these are students who are graduating, and they have a person called a valedictorian, a person called a salutatorian, and these are two people who've been recognized because of academic achievement. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, that looks like a good idea. And this was in eighth grade. So I always was a good student and I liked school. So by, again, good fortune, I was able, when I graduated, to be the valedictorian, class of 46. I was able to become the president of the graduating class. Mm-hmm. Some of that, in fact, gave me more confidence, so that I went to the University of Florida. I was able to do a lot of the same things, so that I was also president of the class of 1950 at the University of Florida. I saw people who were having fun and weren't playing ball, but some of them were cheerleaders. Not that that looked like a lot of fun. So I went out there when I was a junior, became a cheerleader, and then when I was a senior, I became the head cheerleader. And at Florida, there are different places for recognition. One of them is Florida Blue Key, very sought after. So when I was a senior in May of 1950, I became a member of Florida Blue Key. And I had a friend who was one of the editors of the annual. In my good fortune, he said, well, we're picking people for the Hall of Fame for various characters, some for service, some for academics, some for leadership. So he was a part of selecting. So I got picked for the Hall of Fame for leadership, mm-hmm. because it also related to military and ROTC. A lot of these things are built upon what you do and then going higher. And having the experience of leadership and responsibility for others, and you only acquire it if you work at it and if you want to do it. I have a grandson who's very smart, and he was in the Army, and they wanted him to go to officer's training school, but he refused because he doesn't want to be responsible for other people. Mm-hmm. You cannot be a leader in the military unless you're going to be responsible for other people. The only way you could do that is if you're a private with no stripes. Mm-hmm. You're absolute bottom of the heap. But I liked assuming responsibility, and a lot of it started with a scout program right in Fernandina. Are there some other areas that we might think about during that era?
During that era, you mentioned that you were involved with St. Peter's Episcopal
yes.
Church. Could you talk a little bit
yeah,
more about that?
Yeah, sure. When I first came to St. Peter's, I was 9 years old. I had a very good soprano voice, and we had a boys' choir. Mm-hmm. So I was in the boys' choir all the time up until I was 13. I was scheduled to do a solo on Sunday, but I went to the basketball game Saturday night. And I yelled and I screamed, all for the Pirates. And I went down Sunday morning to rehearse before service. And I couldn't hit the high notes. And my choir director said, you will never hit them again. He said, your voice has started to change. This is why you changed from being a boy to a man. And it started right now. You can still be in the choir, but you're not going to be doing any solos. That was also when I was old enough to become an acolyte. On Easter Sunday, 1941, I was confirmed by the Bishop of Florida, and then I was able to be an acolyte. An acolyte is a young man who works with the priest in all of the services, and especially in communion services. And then also did some lay reading, although I wasn't legally able to do it, but I didn't know. One time it was funny, the rector was going to be gone, and I was still in high school. And he said, well, why don't you do morning prayer on Sunday? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I can't be here, but you could read it. Well, more normally it would be an adult who's licensed by a bishop to become a lay reader. Well, I was 17 years old and wasn't licensed by anybody to do anything except drive a car. I have to talk about that. And that's another story. Well, anyhow, I said, okay. So I did it. So I ran the service. I did it. And then I followed the sequence of what I had seen. And I found out I was doing some things which only the priests are supposed to do. Well, I didn't know. But nevertheless, so I pulled it off. It worked. And that was only one time. Mm-hmm. But that brings me to mind of the license, because it's a once-in-a-lifetime story. In those days, you only had to be 14 years old to get a car license in Florida. I turned 14 the summer of 1942. That fall, right after school started, I wanted to go see about getting a license. So my mother was teaching me how to drive. And so I thought I knew enough to go get a license. In those days, the Florida Road Patrol, who worked in the county, would come to the courthouse. And then people would come down there to be tested. And you'd fill out your forms and everything. And the county clerk would work with him. So I went down, and I was the last person. It was probably 4 o'clock or later that day. So I was the last. And he'd been there all afternoon with other young people, probably as poorly as qualified as I was. I came in, and I knew I was last. I came in, and he said, young man, he says, do you know how to drive a car? And I said, yes, sir. And he said, good. Well, I'll sign here. And he signed a paper, and I took it back and got my license. That's it. Wow. I didn't get in a car. I didn't have to park it, do parallel parking. I didn't have to do anything that I was worried about, because he was tired. He had a long day. That's a true story of the easiest driver's license ever issued in the state of Florida.
Yeah. Well, before we wrap up today,
sure.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add? Any, you know, part of your story that you'd like to share?
I was very fortunate to be in Fernandina when I was. During the war years, it was a great place to be. And living on the beach was great, super. Our school was good. We had good teachers. We had good principals. I loved being at St. Peter's Church. We had great rectors there. The town was small enough that you knew most everybody. Schools, our average class was, for graduating classes, was somewhere 25 to 30 people. There was 25 in my class. There was 30 in that class following me. My wife was in the class after me. The social life was great. There was a lot of dating between the boys and the girls in school. Some of them, like me, married their girlfriend from high school. I met my wife when she was 14 and I was 15. Mm-hmm. I had never dated a girl before in my life. I really wasn't interested until I met her. And I met her, and she was beautiful. She was smart. And the great thing about her, all the other teenage girls liked her. That's a real achievement. And I was very lucky that all this started in Fernandina High School and lasted for 76 years, 69 where we were married, 7 we went together before. So we got to know people. That was fairly representative of a lot of people in our generation, so that you had a longer time with one another to share experiences, and we were all blessed.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, thank you so much for sharing your story and your recollections with us.
Okay.
For the museum and the benefit of our whole community.